Good morning. Thanks for listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Now time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
I want people to understand that what sentence Mr. Stone gets at the end of the day will be decided by the courts, not by the prosecutors, not by the defense attorneys. But what we can take great comfort in is that these federal prosecutors are going to do what they think is right.
Even as we are deeply divided right now, we need to bring down the cost of prescription drugs, stop the flow of illicit drugs and human trafficking, and make sure that our veterans get world-class mental health services. Those are just a few things I think we can agree upon in a bipartisan way, but there's so many more.
The people's budget also invests in people and infrastructure in ways that lifts people up, encourages innovation and entrepreneurship, and builds a strong economy from the ground up.
The federal per diem rate average is a nice, even way of doing things, and we'll never, ever have to touch this ever again. So there's an opt-out in there, so some people don't feel comfortable with collecting the average per diem rate, they can opt out.
With us to talk about a new and different Martha McSally ad, a primary challenger to a controversial state senator, and more, our attorney and former congressional staffer, Roy Herrera, and Lorna Romero, owner of Elevate Strategies. Guys, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So before we get started, I would love to hear a few seconds of this Martha McSally ad to give us sort of a jumping off point.
Losing my dad when I was 12, surviving sexual assault, I was able to discover that I had strength that I didn't realize I had. I wasn't going to let myself or others be held back or held down again.
Martha is such an inspiration to me because she has come through her own challenges. She uses that as fuel to fight and to serve. She's fighting for what's right when it comes to pre-existing conditions.
She's used her history, her surviving sexual assault, and used it in a way to where she can help other people and have a big voice for survivors of sexual assault.
So that's about 30 seconds of a new 3-minute ad from Senator Martha McSally. Lorna, one of the criticisms of Senator McSally in the election she lost to Kyrsten Sinema is she didn't allow voters to know enough about her. This seems like quite a twist at the start of this campaign.
I completely agree. This is a completely different direction than what we saw in 2018. That was one of the big criticisms that we heard from folks is, who is Martha McSally? And a number of folks knew about her military background since that seemed to be a focus. But there wasn't much else that was told about her. And so I think this ad really, you know, sets the tone for her election campaign of the direction that she's trying to go in. I mean, it's no secret that she did not perform well with moderate Republican women, independent women, et cetera. And it's very clear that this ad is targeted towards that audience. And the stories, the personal stories that were in this ad are very compelling. So, I mean, it remains to be seen what direction the campaign's going to continue in. But I think for a reintroduction of Martha, especially she's had $8 million in negative ads against her for the past year, I think this is a good stepping stone for her to relaunch this campaign.
Roy, what about this strategy to start off with, knowing what she went through last time? Is it too little too late because voters know her, or can she twist like this?
Well, I mean, I'd also note that on the same day she released this ad, she also released an attack ad. So I don't want to give her too much credit about going in completely a different direction. And that attack ad, I think, was along the lines of a lot of the ads that she ran against Senator Sinema in 2018. But I think it gets to a fundamental problem that she's got, which is that ultimately she's on the ticket with Donald Trump. And to the extent that, you know, we've seen her legislative behavior, it's basically been as a rubber stamp to President Trump. Basically voted his way and everything, of course, voted his way on impeachment. And so I think that's the problem that she's got to address. And maybe she's trying to address this in this ad, because in Arizona, you know, we do have a history of wanting to elect people that are independent. We had that with Senator McCain, who famously didn't get along with President Trump. We have that with Senator Sinema now. And so she's got to balance in a very difficult place, trying to be sort of loyal to Trump, because I think that's what she has to do to get through a primary, for example, but then also trying to actually get moderates and independents to vote for her.
Lorna, what is the balance, I guess, for Senator McSally? Because the last sort of campaign thing that we really heard about her was the liberal hack T-shirts that she was selling, which seems like it would be going in a completely opposite direction from this ad, which is much more about her, the softer music, talking about her as a human being.
I think that's the big question. You're right. I mean, a few weeks ago, everyone was talking about liberal hack and her campaign focusing on selling T-shirts and fundraising off of that. Was that necessarily a planned campaign tactic? I don't know. People have their opinions on that. Obviously, the direction of this ad had been in the works for a while. It takes a lot lot of coordination to get, you know, five individuals to tell personal stories and to speak about their support of Martha McSally. I think the liberal hack thing is probably a one-off that happened, and I would anticipate the direction that the campaign is going to go in is much of what you saw in this ad. She talked about issues that do get bipartisan support. I mean, you're talking about, you know, domestic violence victims, sexual assault victims, the opioid epidemic, you know, people with pre-existing conditions, ALS. And she throws in key buzzwords like bipartisan fashion. You know, there's things that bring us together. So I think this is really is setting the tone of the direction that she's going in. And it's going to be a lot different than what we saw in 2018.
Roy, the thing that was really interesting to me, and Lorna referenced this, was the amount of time that in this ad McSally spends talking about healthcare, specifically pre-existing conditions, especially because that was one of the things that Kyrsten Sinema and the Democrats hammered her on 2 years ago.
Absolutely. I mean, opinion poll after opinion poll nationally in Arizona shows that healthcare costs is the number one issue for voters. And I think Senator Sinema knew that and, you know, I think ran a campaign based on that in 2018 that was successful. And, you know, and she did speak a lot about pre-existing conditions. And Martha McSally spoke a lot about pre-existing conditions in this ad. But then again, it gets back to my earlier point is she runs into a problem because the problem here is that Donald Trump wants to get rid of the Affordable Care Act, which presumably would get rid of some of these pre-existing condition protections that we now have under law. So how could you sort of support him in whole cloth, basically, when the reality is the agenda he wants to push would get rid of that? And she's caught in this vice that I think she's trying to talk her way out of, but ultimately may not be able to.
Lorna, how much does the strategy change for her? Obviously, she was not an incumbent last time, and she had a brutal primary. This time, yes, she has challengers, but it seems like those challengers are pretty weak. So I guess I'm wondering, at what point does a candidate can a candidate play both sides, the softer side and also what Roy mentioned, a little bit more of that harder edge? Can she do those simultaneously, or is a better strategy to introduce herself as this person we maybe didn't get to know and then sort of sprinkle in the stuff? It almost seems like she's trying to do two things at once.
Yeah, and I mean, people thread the needle all the time, especially it seems like it happens all the time with Republican candidates when you actually have a primary. And you actually have a competitive general as well. I mean, the same thing happened with Senator McCain a number of times, Senator Jeff Flake. A number of statewide Republicans always have to deal with this issue of how do we maintain the base, but then also make sure that we are capturing enough moderate Republicans that are swing voters and independents and their support as well. And I think it's oftentimes I think we unfairly judge some of these candidates saying you're either this or that. You can be a little bit of a blend of both. And so I think, you know, the fact that she doesn't have a real primary, let's be honest, you're going to see her focus more on her campaign against Mark Kelly. I mean, Roy referenced that with the second ad that she released this week, which was showing the difference in the comparison between both of them. But honestly, if she is going to pivot too far to the right and not really talk to the voters that she wasn't able to capture in 2020, I think that would be an unfortunate decision from her campaign. She needs to focus on the folks that she wasn't able to capture in 2018.
Lorna, do you think that Senator McSally is worried about losing her base, and should she be?
I'm not sure if she's worried, and I personally don't think she should be concerned. They don't really have an alternative. You know, President Trump, and she supports aspects of his agenda that, you know, that she mentions. I think that'll basically check the box. I don't think those folks will ever vote for Mark Kelly. I guess there's a question of do they just abstain from that race altogether? But I think she has them. And so it really is making sure that she's successful in a general election.
And Roy, is this going to be a race to the middle, do you think?
Well, I agree with a lot of what Lorna just said. I mean, candidates all the time do have to thread that needle between their base and sort of the more moderate swing voter. I think that what makes things more challenging for McSally, and it's in this case more challenging than in other instances, is that we've got a president, you know, whose base that, you know, she's got to subscribe to, who is historically unpopular, right? I mean, he is the most divisive president I think we've had from, you know, at least from polling in a long time, at least certainly in my adulthood. And so a lot of times, you know, yes, you have to subscribe to the base. You have to make sure that they're happy. But what happens when the base's position is so unpopular with moderates and swing voters? How do you satisfy both in that scenario? And I think that's her challenge.
One dynamic I find interesting, and I don't think I'm overstating it to say that Kyrsten Sinema ran a brilliant campaign when she ran against Martha McSally. Mark Kelly's not an experienced, he's very experienced as a public person, but not in terms of campaigning. So can she take this chance of trying to reinvent herself in an easier fashion going against an inexperienced candidate than she would have against Sinema?
Well, I mean, Mark Kelly is inexperienced in the sense he hasn't ran before. But if you look at his record as, you know, an astronaut, as an engineer, sure, as a business leader, as someone who has been involved in public policy fights, you know, with gun control, for example, he is experienced in that sense. And so, and he's also going to have the resources, of course, to sort of back that up. So, I mean, there's challenges that are unique to every race. I think she's going to have a very tough race, of course, against Mark Kelly, because that's going to be, you know, really a top-level candidate.
I think she has a better opportunity with Mark Kelly than what was presented with Kyrsten Sinema. Kyrsten Sinema was a sitting congresswoman in a very, you know, bipartisan district. I mean, that was probably the most competitive district that we have in Arizona. People were used to seeing her on the ballot, especially in Maricopa County, where the majority of voters are. Mark Kelly doesn't have that luxury. He's based out of Tucson. He's been involved in some public policy issue fights, but people don't really know Mark Kelly. And so I think that's why you saw Martha take the opportunity this week to say, here's Mark Kelly. Here's me trying to define him before he has the opportunity to define himself. And so I think she's well positioned in that regard, which is a lot different than Kyrsten Sinema, because she already had significant name ID versus Mark Kelly.
Anything to make of the timing of this ad? I mean, coming out in February, obviously we're a long way away from the primary and the general. This seems to be sort of the unofficial launch of her campaign. Anything to make of when she released this?
I personally think that they were trying to get past the impeachment noise. I think that makes the most sense, because obviously that's been going on for months at this point. So that's been behind them, and now they can just focus on their campaign messaging. I honestly thought it was kind of late to do a reintroduction. Probably, you know, Mark Kelly did his, what, September, October? I don't even remember when it was last year. So a little late, but I think it's to get past all the other distractions that have been consuming all of the media attention.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at the end of this, the Arizona voters are going to know both of them very well, right? I mean, we're going to have so much money spent on this race that I think they're going to know them very, very well. And I think it really comes down to sort of the beginning of our conversation is which one of the candidates does the best job in talking about the issues that Arizonans care about, which is healthcare costs primarily. And can you talk about that in an honest way? And I take this back to sort of the problem that McSally has with Trump, because Trump obviously has his own positions on what healthcare reform looks like. And can McSally sort of square that with what Arizonans want? That's her challenge. Whereas with Mark Kelly, he's talking about costs and lowering them.
If 2018 indicates that Arizona is in fact purple, if we want to label it that, who is going to be more of the albatross then? Trump for McSally, or Pelosi, for example, or the impeachment folks like Adam Schiff for Mark Kelly?
You know, that's a good question, because I question how much impeachment's going to matter 9 months from now. I've said this before, and I'm going to say it again. If Democrats are going to hang their hat on talking about impeachment between now and the general election, I think that's a failed strategy. I think people are over it. So, but on the flip side, people already know Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi. They hear their names all the time. They have their opinions of them. The Donald Trump phenomenon, I've never been able to put my finger on it. Just when you think it's going to be something that's going to be potentially catastrophic for the party, something else happens and it reinvigorates the party even more. I mean, the economy's doing well. He has his highest, you know, approval rating that he's had so far. You know, the recent Gallup poll showed that, you know, the majority of Americans say that they're better off today than they were a year ago. That's hard to run against. When people are doing well and they're happy and the economy's performing well, it's really hard to vote against that. So something could happen between now and November, but I think right now, the way that Donald Trump is positioned as well, and we still don't know who the Democrat presidential nominee is going to be. There's been such a cluster on the Democrat side the past few weeks. That's a giant question mark. And if it's a Bernie Sanders type, you know, I think that's just a home run for Donald Trump and Republicans.
Well, I'd sort of, to your first point, I think I'd flip that around a little bit, which is that the economy is really good, yet Donald Trump's approval ratings are so low, yet he is, you know, underwater in a lot of ratings and a lot of polling. And so to me, that shows like, well, he's doing something wrong himself, right? Because historically speaking, somebody that would be in that position with a strong economy would be sort of a shoe-in for reelection. But the other thing that you said, I totally agree with, which is that, you know, ultimately it's going to come down to who's the Democrat at the top of the ticket, which we just don't know, right? And so I don't think it's going to really be Pelosi that matters or Schumer, but it's probably going to be whoever that person is. If it's Bloomberg or Biden or Bernie Sanders, that's going to change things.
Well, Roy, very quickly, I'm curious if it's too much of a stretch to say that we won't really know how the U.S. Senate race in Arizona is going to go until we know who the Democratic presidential nominee is.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't go so far as that, right? I mean, I think, in other words, there's some sort of independence here. The Senate race could go a certain way, then maybe the presidential goes a different way. But that is certainly a factor. So when we see sort of, I mean, for example, if we have a Bernie Sanders, I think that general election race looks differently in Arizona than it is for Joe Biden or Michael Bloomberg or Amy Klobuchar or someone someone like that who's a bit more moderate. And so that certainly will have a greater effect on the Senate race. But, for example, whoever the presidential candidate is on the Democratic side, it's going to be super competitive in the Senate race. And I think whoever wins that race is largely going to do that sort of as an independent factor than the presidential.
Yeah, I agree with Roy. When it comes to these U.S. Senate races and, you know, whether it's during an election cycle where the Republican nominee is the one that's in question or a Democrat nominee, these candidates have to run their own independent race. I mean, we saw this in 2016 with Senator McCain. We didn't know who was going to be at the top of the ticket, and we just ran our campaign regardless of who was going to be at the top of it. We didn't let any of that define John McCain or the race in general. And I think you're probably going to see that with Mark Kelly as well. So I think it's completely separate. Will there be some nuances that probably impact some voters, some issues that pop up where, you know, reporters are going to go to these candidates and say, well, what are your thoughts about this? Or so-and-so said this. Of course, that's going to happen. But these candidates are really just going to focus on defining themselves and running their own race.
Okay, that's Lorna Romero. Also here is Roy Herrera with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Friday NewsCap continues after this. It's the Friday NewsCap on KJZ Easy with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Our guest today, Lorna Romero, owner of Elevate Strategies, and former congressional staffer and attorney Roy Herrera. All right, guys, let's turn to more local stuff. Lorna, let me start with you. So we have a controversial state senator, Michelle Ugenti-Reda. Looks like no ethics investigation, but there's still a cloud hanging over her. She's going to get a challenger in her district, a former Republican lawmaker himself, Adam Quastman. What do you make of the fact that she's going to face a primary challenge?
You know, I honestly don't make too much of it just because of the fact that, you know, Adam Quastman is a former legislator. And there's been rumblings for years that he was probably looking to come back to the legislature anyways. And so here was an opportunity to do it, and now he's doing it. I think the bigger question is how much of an issue this becomes over the next few months, if there's pressure for there to be an investigation. I mean, the Senate's made it clear that they don't intend to do so. So I don't know how much of an issue that's going to be. Ugenti-Reda is very popular and well-known in her district. So it's up to Quastman is if this is going to be the linchpin issue that he runs against her with. Because I also don't know how widespread this controversy has been in her district in particular. Amongst Capitol, you know, circle groups and all of us pundits that are, that, you know, live and breathe around the legislature, we're well aware of it. But I don't know how many of her actual voters are aware of it.
Well, so what is intriguing to me, and I actually live in that district, it intrigues me to see you have the other two lawmakers are extremely, let's say, experienced in age, and then you have someone who's a great contrast there. Voters in Fountain Hills, for example, if they hear something that sounds like a controversial sexual issue, let's say, does that make them less comfortable? Not based on any other work she's actually done at the Capitol. I'm just wondering if that's if it's an older demo, would they be more offended by this, let's say?
Potentially. I mean, it depends on how that opponent is messaging it to those people. Because I've seen some times where folks have attacked folks about, you know, these kind of sexual encounters in the past, and it's backfired. It's actually made them look like a victim. So it depends on how Adam Quastman intends to run against her and how he messages that. But you're right. It could be something that people find shocking and offensive, and it could potentially harm her. But, you know, it's a giant question mark when it comes to Adam Quastman and what platform and position he's going to run on.
Well, Roy Quastman has definitely made this an issue and said that he intends to make it an issue. Do you see this as something that voters in that district are going to care about?
Well, I don't pretend to be sort of the expert of local GOP primary politics, unfortunately. I think that, you know, maybe Lorna knows that a little better than I do. I would think that it's an issue. I mean, we know, and I don't think we need to go over the details of the allegations, but we know what the allegations are. They're very serious, I think, if they're true, very inappropriate, certainly sort of conduct that I think is sort of beneath what we should expect of our Arizona legislators. So I look at that and say to myself, well, if I was a voter, whether I'm Republican or Democrat, I probably don't want somebody like that going to the legislature. In, you know, GOP circles in Fountain Hills, I don't know. You know, maybe it is an issue, maybe it isn't. I think to Lorna's point, it really kind of depends on how her opponent presents this and if he does it in a way that doesn't make her end up looking better in the end of it.
An issue like this, is it in some ways, I don't want to say easier, but is it maybe easier to make it a political issue because it's something that's easy for voters to understand as opposed to like a embezzlement or tax issues like we've seen some of the stuff with David Schweiker. And that hasn't really become much of a political issue because it's kind of a complicated issue to explain to voters. But this is a pretty easy one to explain to voters.
I mean, it's an easy topic to explain. And people have a tendency to lean towards this stuff more because it's salacious and it's a good headline, et cetera. But you have to be careful. You have to be careful how you message this stuff. Because like we said before, it can completely backfire. We've seen other kind of salacious mail pieces go out in different districts on different topics before, and it actually made the candidate win like 2-1 that they were trying to attack. And so it really just depends. But I agree. Is it easy to message? Yes. It's how you do it, because obviously it doesn't involve complicated terms like embezzlement, like you mentioned.
One of the things Quasman has said is that her, Senator Eugenie Reed's, the scandal could put the GOP majority in the Senate at risk. Do you buy into that?
Well, I think the GOP majority in the Senate is at risk. I'm not sure it's at risk because of this particular district, though, right? I mean, so things are going to happen that would flip the chamber, and certainly the House is completely at risk for the GOP. Are in other districts, they're, again, sort of relying on other factors, those particular candidates, things like that. So I'm not sure that's the case. But again, I kind of go back to my earlier point, which is that, you know, I look at these allegations and I say to myself, like, well, this is really bad. But I also sort of constantly catch myself in the Trump era thinking all the time about, like, oh, well, that's definitely going to sink somebody. And it doesn't, right? So it's sort of hard to predict what happens these days, especially when what we're talking about are sort of personal behavior and things like that.
One other question for me on this topic has to do with just the idea of a popular incumbent being challenged. We're seeing that to a lesser extent with Nancy Bartow against Heather Carter. Bartow's, again, a former lawmaker or lawmaker who's trying to change the body. Mm-hmm. So how much does that affect even just inside GOP politics? Is this something that people say, well, okay, we're not happy, but we're not investigating her, so Quasman, we'd prefer you stay out?
You know, I don't look into it. It's a completely different dynamic than the Heather Carter and Nancy Bartow because they're both sitting lawmakers. Adam Quasman's been out of the game for a while. So for me, it just looks like any other normal challenger that would want to come in against Michelle Eugenie Reed. I don't think it's necessarily raising red flags amongst GOP circles. Mind you, I'm not in that district. I'm not involved with their local politics. But I don't think this scenario in and of itself is causing anybody to raise red flags. I mean, you see that on the Republican and Democrat side all the time where, you know, people come in and try to challenge the incumbent because they don't think they're, you know, progressive enough or, you know, conservative enough. It happens pretty frequently. This is obviously a different reason why they're jumping in. But, you know, her getting a challenger in and of itself isn't anything I think that's too newsworthy.
Roy, let's change topics. I'm wondering, plus or minus to have Corporation Commission members appointed?
You know, I've been on the show before, and we've talked about whether certain positions for public office should go to the voters or whether they should be appointed, right? And, you know, we talk about county assessor, for example, which is a largely ministerial job. But CorpCom, you know, they set policy. They are the regulators. And so to me, the idea that they could be appointed by the governor does the opposite of getting rid of the special interests, because ultimately all of those special interests are just going to go to the governor and the governor's race in order to make sure that he appoints people that are friendly to them. So it doesn't solve the problem at all. And I think having sort of people be able to vote directly for their corporation commissioners is the better thing.
Lorna, does it make sense this is coming up?
I think it makes sense. And obviously, this isn't something that's been talked about for a long time. There's been numerous conversations, not just about corporation commission, but should the mine inspector be appointed? Should a superintendent be, you know, appointed? All of these other, you know, statewide roles or even local roles that traditionally in other states are appointed, but in Arizona, we elect them. I think whatever process makes sense where we get qualified individuals on the commission. I mean, that is a very technical role. I won't even pretend to tell you that I understand how the Corporation Commission works and the nuances and all the different regulations you have to understand. But I think it needs to be a professional entity. And in my personal opinion, I don't think it's a bad idea for it to be an appointed role. What we've seen in the past is it kind of becomes a place where former legislators go next, you know, and no offense to former legislators that are currently in the commission. I think they're all great. But that's just one of the things where you've seen that or somebody who wants to run for statewide office, like a different statewide office. But this is their first like test run because it is a statewide, you know, position. So I just think whatever scenario it is where we get a highly qualified commission is the best way to grow. And I don't think having a conversation about it being an appointed entity is a bad conversation to have.
Roy, one of the proposals would, I believe, require that no more than three of the five members are from the same party. So let's say that this were to go into effect. In theory, it could help the Democrats, right? Because for most of the time, it's either one or zero Democrats on the commission.
Certainly, it could. But again, kind of go back to the sort of the beginning point here, which is that, well, ultimately, it's the governor that's going to decide this. And so there's going to be all kinds of sort of machinations from the special interest groups on both sides to make sure that not only that they're getting a Democrat or Republican that they like, but the kind of Democrat they like, the kind of Republican they like. And so, again, to me, having Arizonans have the ability to sort of directly say, like, this is who we want in the CorpCom is the better option. And it kind of gets into this sort of larger point that I make sometimes, which is, you know, be careful what you wish for, right? I mean, you may like changing this now if you are the sort of the ruling party, but you may not like it down the road because it's going to completely change, you know, if we have a different governor that you don't like and is appointing people like that. So you have to be careful what you wish for in this kind of instance.
Lorna, our final minute. President Trump coming to Phoenix next week. How many times are we going to see him between now and November?
I think we're going to see him quite a few times between now and November. I mean, we're early in the game right now. This is kind of the Trump victory tour post-impeachment and him having a really good State of the Union address, in my opinion. So I think this is the initial, you know, victory tour that he's going to do. And I think you're going to see him come back to Arizona quite a few times because this is considered obviously, you know, asterisk, depending on who the Democrat nominee is, it's considered a competitive state.
Roy, do you anticipate that that politicians from both parties will be trying to use his appearance here for their purposes?
Oh, absolutely. And I predict, if he's coming here next week, that the kind of rally he's going to have is going to be much less like the State of the Union and more like his press conference the next day, which was completely unhinged, right? I mean, that's kind of what he clearly is sort of placating to his base by giving them red meat. I imagine we're going to see a lot of red meat here in Arizona. And on the Democratic side, I think we will try to take advantage of that because a lot of that red meat is not, I think, what sort of moderate Arizonans, what swing voters in Arizona want to hear.
I think hopefully pollsters will take advantage of next week to say that President Trump can say his numbers are good. Martha's, we'll see, sort of like he did in that. Lorna Romero of Elevate Strategies, Roy Herrero from our congressional staffer. Guys, thanks as always.
Thank you.